The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The cheering section in the front here, I have to say, is not paid to cheer. But our dear and close friends of our son, who wouldn't be wild, no. And so thank you for that. Comrades and friends, and Malcolm always used to like to say, and enemies, and there are some of you out there. Go back and listen to the speeches. He was right, unfortunately. Oh! I knew it. It's Rochester messing with me again. Okay. Malcolm, for those who don't remember, was assassinated as he came up to speak at the Audubon Ballroom on January the 21st, 1965. And I use the word Malcolm with honor, but let's not remember what this country has done to a previous generation of revolutionaries that really shaped the period since the 1960s. And so to them and to those who came before us, I'd like to thank everyone who has been involved in building, supporting, working very hard, from branches around the country to people we've never met before, who said, you know what? Socialism is a good idea. And I like the organization of this conference and those sponsors of the conference. And I just want to list them. They're in the program. They're everywhere in our publicity. But it's a way, really, of acknowledging the various groups and forces involved. Behzad Ragin mentioned the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, which is the parent, or is the non-profit umbrella group, umbrella organization that both the International Socialist Review and Haymarket Books operate under, including, or in addition to, the website wearemany.org, which I have to say, for those of you who don't know wearemany.org, it is this conference every year for, I don't know, well, that's not a good one. Huh? Since who?
2008. Since 2008.
Thank you, comrades. You know, it's the memory is beginning to go. Every conference since 2008, but much more than that. It's speakers and authors of Haymarket Books. It's people in the movement. It's a great resource. I also want to thank the journal Jacobin, whom we've been working with. And want to thank them for their efforts and our common efforts, along with another sponsor of the conference, Socialist Worker, Jacobin and Socialist Worker Exchange. Exchange an awful lot of material and collaborate closely. And I'd like to thank the International Socialist Organization for its steadfastness and support of the conference, an organization that was founded, not that I hold a grudge, on March the 12th, 1977, 40 years ago. Some of us were there then and are proud to be here now, but are more proud of the organization now than we were then. And I'll let you figure out why. I'd like to urge people to join to support financially and otherwise in any and every way possible the sponsoring organizations. If you do nothing else, join one of them. You don't want to, I'm not a joiner, well, become one. You want to discuss it? There'll be about 1,000+ people at the bar, and you may even get a few free drinks in the right situation. But I say that, jokes aside, because one of the things we need, as Behzad mentioned, is money. And it takes a lot of money to work in this country. We are in a, well, let's just be straight and not let my, we are in a 4-star hotel, apparently. You know, that doesn't have a bar, that doesn't have a, anyway, etc. Something that I note for the record, because as much as we like this space, they've had 2 conferences now of Forces for Change. One a few weeks ago, which I think attracted 4,000 people. I know what it is. I didn't want to add. Okay. I'm sorry, people don't know? Oh, the People's Summit, which gathered 4,000 people and is an important actor in the radicalization that is taking place in this country, and then ours with 2,000 people. And it's kind of odd for comrades from other countries to go, oh, I see, you have a socialist conference in a 4-star hotel. So what, anyway, what I'm saying is there's no infrastructure. There's no money. You don't get space for free. You can't use university space. Even if you're a big university organization, you gotta pay. You know why? Because you gotta pay for everything. You gotta pay. Because we want you to pay. We wouldn't want you to come up getting fed with a gold spoon. Look what it did to the President of the United States. I also want to thank the speakers who came, and of course all the folks who came, but I want to take a step back and thank the contribution of 2 astonishing women who participated in the conference, who I think deserve special mention, because several people have told me, I was involved in another meeting on the 2 occasions that they spoke, but that the meetings around the Gumbaheen River Collective were, and I quote, life-changing. And I just want to say, those particular words came from a particular individual who I won't embarrass, but there's nothing to be embarrassed about, who is been in the movement longer than I have. So that's even more years. For him to say they were life-changing is, I think, a testament to Danita Frazier and Barbara Smith. And I think we are. And it is my pleasure to announce, for those of you who don't know, that a book by Haymarket Press, which involves them and others, edited by Kianga Yamada Taylor, is due to be produced later this year. I'm speaking more calmly and methodically than I usually do, and I realize I've already spoken 10 minutes, so I'll try to pick up the pace without losing the essence. I also want to thank and highlight the participation of international comrades, of comrades from other countries, at a level and participation that I don't think we've seen before. For the last few years, Dea in Greece, an organization called Le Mouvement pour le Socialisme, which is the Movement for Socialism in Switzerland, and the ISO have been attempting to reconstitute a revolutionary left on a new footing around the world, mainly in Europe. And I want to here particularly thank the NPS, who undertook considerable expenses to help underwrite flights for comrades from Europe, and to point out that we will be having another meeting of this international network in Portugal, hosted by members of the Bloco, that's the broad far-left organization that exists there, and will involve a whole number of the groups. We have people here from Australia, from Britain, from Canada, the Canadian state, that is both from English-speaking Canada and Quebec, from Greece, from Scotland, from Puerto Rico, from Italy, from France, from Switzerland, and I'm sure there are many more that I don't even know about. So thank you all. There is one group of comrades who are not and did not attend this year because of the situation that they face at home. And that is our Egyptian comrades, who are facing increased repression. 300 comrades were picked up 300 comrades were picked up about a week and a half ago. Only the left. General Sisi. Sisi. I got it. Ally. Loyal servant and counter-revolutionary master of Egypt is sitting on a powder keg. I went to Egypt with my family. The day we left, they floated the Egyptian currency. You could get, formally from banks, $1 for every 8 Egyptian pounds. The day we left, they floated the currency. The pound, or the dollar, was worth 18 and a half Egyptian pounds. That is to say, overnight, the currency lost half of its value. It is now standing at 20 to the dollar. That is a huge assault on the living standards of ordinary and quite poor people, and Sisi is hanging on for life, because someday the dam is going to break.
That's right.
And the dam will break. Now, I want to I thank all these folks, but I also want to raise the fact that we've grown. The left has grown, but of course, it's under conditions that are very threatening. And here for a moment, I want to just acknowledge and take very seriously the fact that several people in this room, and many other people not in this room, have been the victims of and are on hit lists by members of the alt-right. These people harass, use violence, threaten the lives of people under the ludicrous notion of free speech. You know the free speech we got in Fox News. If you're part of the club, speak freely. If you're not, you don't belong to the club. And I'll tell you more about the club at the end. Bravado in this situation, you know, bring it on. is something that I feel, but it's not a political approach, because that's, you know, if you want to match thug for thug, a lot of people in this country are willing to go thug for thug. And you know what? If attacked, I'll defend our side against the right-wing thugs. Always. Always. But we also have to protect our own, to return to the idea that an injury to one is an injury to all. There is a proud history in this country of socialism. Over a long period of time, they tried to erase that history. For years, it was said, the ISO, well, I don't know if people said, people actually said, socialism, haven't you read Werner Sombart? Sorry, he's a sociologist who said, socialism, never in America. Dreams of socialism will crash on the shoals of roast beef and apple pie. But it was, there was a whole thing, socialism will never exist. People on the left used to say, if only you would call yourself, I don't know. Greenish. Slightly reddish. A serious point. It was illegal in the labor movement to belong to communist organizations. People lost their jobs and were hounded out. It's not a fear that comes out of nowhere. But we insisted in 1977 that you had to maintain the flame of socialism alive. Bernie Sanders' campaign helped rekindle that flame. But never forget that without the tenacious work and contribution of socialists, that flame would not be rekindled in this country the way it has been. I need to sum up. So I'm now getting to the politics, it says here, Ahmed politics. We celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and we do so because, despite all, unfortunately, the Russian Revolution is the highest point that our movement ever produced. It has all its detractors, you know. Don't you know that Lenin led to the gulag? It's like the people who said about the French Revolution, don't you know that the Jacobins led to fascism? It's true. There's a whole school of thought that says the terror in France led to right-wing. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? What happened is that there was a counter-revolution in Russia, and that the system put up all defenses, like it did against the French Revolution, to make sure that the idea of insurrection, of changing the rules, of changing the system, got wiped out. Leon Trotsky once said, had we not made a revolution in Russia to end the carnage of the First World War, fascism would have been a Russian word. Instead, communism became the word. But we're celebrating, but do not forget that the last 100 years didn't see revolution. It saw uninterrupted counter-revolution. What do you think the accession of fascism in Italy was about, and the suppression of the workers' movement? What happened in Germany, which ended up with the extermination of Jews in the camps, began by the Nazis fighting for the streets first, murdering communists, murdering socialists, murdering Christians, murdering anyone who they felt they could get away with murdering, and then they said, now we're ready for state power. And they were anointed state power. There was a movement after the Second World War and the defeat of fascism that brought new hope. We are heading back into the darkness of the 20th century in the 21st century, and we should not be doing that. I had the opportunity and the necessity to see my mother, who's quite old now, lives alone in London. And I got there the day after Grenfell. After Grenfell! Why am I shouting? Because you couldn't make this stuff up. You could not make it up. I am proud to say we have a brother from Baltimore. I don't know where Gary is. All right, man. Who's a firefighter in Baltimore. And he got up and said, "Do you know what it's like as a person who fights fire to see people burn up? Just burn up. Over what? 5,000 pounds of a different insulation?" Business Week writes, well, some op-ed. Well, you can't blame the lack of regulation. Why not? Well, because regulation, first businesses have to accept it. Then it takes time to implement. $5,000? The bodies are still burning. And they're telling you this is the society, which is why a new generation of people are saying we will not live in these kind of conditions. And it has rekindled the movement in Britain. And everything that these people have done to ordinary working people for the last 40 years will come back at them. I am convinced of that. I want that to happen. And I want to end by quoting George Carlin. He said at one stage, and I'm sorry, it's a really good punchline. It's not mine. It's Carlin's. He said, and I'm combining two skits. I watch him a lot. You know, in this country, remember, this is a country that was founded by slave owners who wanted to be free. Let me repeat that to you. Slave owners who wanted to be free. At another stage, he says, yeah, people say jobs. I want jobs. Sure, a little nuclear radiation, I'll take that. So long as it means jobs. And he adds, because I am not an elitist about the American working class. He adds, these are the choices American workers have been left to make. These are the choices. Whether you're blue collar, white collar, pink collar, it doesn't matter. You do not belong to the club. You don't belong. They don't care about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. You know, the American dream, you only believe in it if you're asleep.
Introduce our next speaker. I just want to report on something that a comrade from Charlottesville, Virginia told me. And if you have not been watching the news, due to attending many important sessions, I just want to encourage people to look that up. There is a Klan rally happening there right now. There is another rally being planned for August by multiple right-wing forces, from the Proud Boys to the Three Percenters, and so on. In addition, this comrade told me that there are Black Lives Matter protesters and other groups that are being denied a permit by the mayor, and that it is in fact police who are cracking down and arresting the protesters against the right. This tells what side those forces are on. It's not only the right-wing forces that have been galvanized in the wake of Trump's election that are coming out and crawling out from under these disgusting holes where they live. It's also the state apparatus that has always, from the beginning, been in cahoots and has never been on our side of defending. And that's why I think the speaker I'm about to introduce is going to speak to something so important, which is how can we ourselves defend our movements? What is that going to look like? And how can we actually build that? So Wael El-Assadi is a member. Yep. Wael is a member of the ISO in Portland and is a contributor to Socialist Worker. People should make sure they get a copy of this month's Socialist Worker, which has an excellent interview with Wael about their mobilization against the United Against Hate, or as the United Against Hate rally. And I think it has a lot of important lessons for us today. So without further ado, Wael.
In Portland on May 26, Jeremy Christian, a known right-wing racist who'd recently attended a far-right rally, began yelling slurs at two women, one of them wearing a hijab. He said, "Get the fuck out of the bus and get out of my country because you don't pay taxes." Three men intervened to stop his racist tirade. Christian stabbed them all in the neck, killing two of them. Ricky John Best, a 53-year-old Army veteran and a City of Portland employee, and Talesian Nemkai Meche, a 23-year-old who just recently graduated from Reed College, were taken from their families too soon for having the courage to stand against an act of bigotry. Micah Fletcher, 21-year-old Portland State University student and an anti-racist poet who regularly spoke out against Islamophobia, survived only after 2 hours of surgery. These brazen racist murders shocked the city of Portland. But as we know, this was not an isolated attack. Only 1 week earlier, Richard Collins III, an African-American student, was murdered by another known white supremacist on his very own campus at the University of Maryland. This murder took place after members of the American Vanguard had plastered white supremacist flyers around the campus, and after a noose was found hanging in the frat house kitchen where the majority of the staff were black. In Sterling, Virginia, Nabra Hassanin, a 17-year-old, was walking with her friends to a local mosque to attend the night prayers during Ramadan when an assailant attacked her with a baseball bat, leaving her dead. Nabra, like Micah in Portland and Richard in Maryland, were not only victims of hate crimes, they were also fighters against racism. It's impossible to list every single act of racist hate, violence, and intimidation by the far right, because unfortunately, they've become daily occurrences in this country since the election of Donald Trump. But it's not only incidents of individual terror that we're facing. The extreme right is organizing and recruiting on the streets, instigating violence against left-wing demonstrators under the cover of free speech to support the most reactionary policies of the Trump administration. And they've begun to go on the offensive. In Florida, members of Identity Europa stormed into and disrupted a racial justice conference. And in San Diego, members of the Proud Boys harassed the speakers and tried to shut down an impeached Trump rally just this last week. The far right in the U.S. has become more confident, organized, aggressive, and violent than at any time than most of us have been organizing, and for most of us since we've been even alive. Now, fascism emerged in Europe in the 20th century as a battering ram to smash the threat of an already existing mass workers movement, which threatened capitalism with social revolution in the midst of economic and social crisis. Today, a fascist movement is attempting to assemble itself, to snuff out our side before we can even manage to emerge as a sustained mass resistance to the onslaught that the ruling class is planning to accelerate against our side to solve the crisis that they face today. And we can't ignore that the terror of the far right and the racist onslaught by the Trump administration have created a real sense of fear, especially among immigrants and Muslims in this country. But if there's fear, there's also real courage, solidarity, and determination. Courage and solidarity is what we saw when three heroes in Portland refused to allow an act of racist intimidation to go unchallenged. Courage and solidarity is today on display in D.C., where people are organizing to stand up to the racist violence which took the lives of Richard Collins and Nabr Hassanan. Courage and solidarity is displayed by professors and activists targeted by the right, some of whom are here today, who refuse to be cowed in the silence by these bigots. And courage and solidarity was on display in Portland when over 2,000 people refused to cave to the pressure of the Democratic Party, who told us to cancel our rallies, and instead people came out, vastly outnumbering the far right, sending the message that they're a hateful minority that will not stomp through our cities. And we have to be clear that important acts of resistance that we've seen and the solidarity in these opening skirmishes with the far right have happened in spite of the efforts of the so-called leaders of the resistance. The liberal establishment and the Democratic Party at every opportunity tell us that we should ignore this growing threat, that our protests only give them attention that they seek. In Portland, the far right murdered two people in broad daylight and wanted to follow that up by stomping triumphantly through our streets just the following week. The response of liberal politicians was not to call for a mass citywide rally to reject this racist violence in the heart of our city, but rather to attempt to demobilize and disorganize those who wanted to resist. Jesse Jackson flew in not to help lead the fight back for a city who was in shock and mourning, but to call on those of us who wanted to demonstrate our anger and speak out against the growing threat of white supremacy to cancel our counter-demonstration. Comrades, luckily, most did not heed Jesse Jackson's call to put our hands side by side in the sand. And this was critical, Because the goal of far-right movements is to dominate the streets, to intimidate their opponents, and that is the way they want to build a layer of mass support. If they're left unchallenged, they'll only gain more momentum, more confidence, more recruits. If they're left unchallenged, they will rehabilitate their image as a legitimate political force in society. If left unchecked, the conservative establishment is more than willing to tap into this political current and in the process grant them the legitimacy that they seek. And that's why in Portland, James Buchall, the chair of the Portland Multnomah County Republican Party, 1 week after a far-right extremist carried out a double murder, called for Republicans to use militia groups like the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters of Security, and the Multnomah Republican Party this last week voted that in. The good news, comrades, is that while the far-right has more confidence today, it is still a force that is in formation. And that is why we must mobilize to confront the right now and ensure that they do not have unchallenged space to organize and recruit. We must send the message to those who are considering joining their movement that they will face determined resistance at every single turn. We must send the message that we will not allow fascists to become a legitimate force in this society. But how we confront the far right also matters. The single-minded focus on street fighting to confront the right in place of mass mobilizations by activists like those in Antifa only strengthen the fascists. The far right is not afraid of street brawls with a small number of isolated radicals. In fact, they thrive on it. It gives the false appearance that they're opposed only by a small minority in this society. And it provides them with an atmosphere by which they can radicalize, initiate, and harden their supporters. We instead need to build united fronts that could draw in the broadest layer of people who want to stand up to the right. There was nothing more powerful than seeing unions, racial justice groups, immigrant rights groups, faith groups, socialists, and throngs of ordinarily Portland residents arriving with their banners and homemade signs to fight the right. And this strategy of both confronting the right wherever they rear their heads and doing it by mobilizing masses of people is not something that we can take for granted. It's something that we have to argue for and win on the left as well as prove in practice. And comrades, the Women's March, the airport protest, the climate justice and science march show us that the potential to build a mass fight back exists. This is a president that is loathed by the majority of people in this country. But if we can't rely on a minority of radicals to fight the right on our behalf, neither can we rely on the state to restrict free speech or ban them out of existence. Not only does this play into the far right strategy, they want to show themselves as helpless victims, but more importantly, calling on the state to ban their rallies or their events hands them the power to cancel our rallies and our events tomorrow. We cannot trust the state, which is the largest purveyor of violence in the entire world, with our civil rights that we want. That doesn't mean that we don't expose the hypocrisy of what the far right is doing at every turn. They're using free speech as a cover to organize a white supremacist movement that aims to take away all of our civil rights, including our right to free speech. Killing people on a train is not a question of free speech. Hanging a noose At the outside, the African American History Museum is not a question of free speech. Attacking and assaulting Muslims in the streets of this country is not a question of free speech. These people are organizing for exactly the opposite. Their aim is to intimidate Muslims and immigrants into silence. Their aim is to attack the Black Lives Matter movement and our movements for racial justice into silence. And their aim is to attack organizations of the left, including socialists, as they threaten in every single speech that they give. So as we fight the right, we must be the ones who champion the defense and extension of democratic rights, which are under threat not only by them, but also by the state. And finally, comrades, I want to say that this is going to be a long struggle. It's not going to be a matter of a protest or two to be able to send them back. We know that the election of Donald Trump, a sexist, Islamophobic, and anti-immigrant bigot, to the White House will continue to give confidence to the growth of the far right. But the roots of this phenomenon lie even deeper and predate Trump. Both Democrats and Republicans have carried out policies that have laid the foundations for the growth of the far right. It was years of the war on terror under the Obama administration which has normalized Islamophobia that has allowed them to grow. It is years of deporting immigrants under the Obama administration that has built up anti-immigrant lives that has allowed them to grow. And it is years of attacks that have devastated the lives of working people and driven many to despair that is allowing them to grow. And what does the Democratic Party have to say about this? That America is already great. That at least we're not Trump. But the right thrives on despair and that kind of elitism. And it channels it towards scapegoating, racism, and nationalism, the anger and fear that people have. So ultimately, to defeat the right, we not only have to challenge them in the streets, but we have to provide a more compelling political alternative that identifies the real source of our misery for the vast majority of people in this country that's built for the wealthy at the expense of the rest of us. We have to provide a different vision for society. A society based on equality where immigrants are not terrorized by ICE. And African Americans do not suffer police violence and brutality and terror. Where women have control over their bodies and decisions. Where working people of all races and genders don't have to struggle every single day just to pay the bills. And when getting an education doesn't mean being up to your eyeballs in debt. Where healthcare is not a privilege for the few, but a right for every single person in this country. And yes, comrades, where borders are replaced with welcome signs for immigrants and refugees across the world. I want to end by saying that we have to build the socialist alternative to this system and the despair that it breeds. And comrades, if there's anything that this past year has shown us and that this conference has proven to us, is that there is no better time to build that socialist alternative than today.
All right. So before I introduce our last speaker, I just want to let people know that I'm going to have a few announcements. So as soon as our last speaker is done, please sit tight. They're important, and they tell you where you're going to end up after this. Don't leave. It's a surprise. Our last speaker will be Jen Roche. Jen Roche is a writer for the International Socialist Review, Socialist Worker, Jacobin magazine, and many other publications on the left. And she's an organizer with the New York City International Socialist Organization. Please put your hands together for Jen Roche. Wow. How many people who are here joined a protest either in the days following Trump's election or after his inauguration? I mean, this is incredibly important because if you think about the night that Trump was elected, we were all in a state of shock. But the fact that we woke up the next morning and saw demonstrations in cities across this country told us something about the world that we live in. It told us that Trump does not have a mandate. It told us that people will stand up and reject the bigotry and the racism. And these demonstrations were crucial because this is something that can be easy to forget. Because the 6 months since, and I think Wael and Ahmed spoke to it so well, the 6 months since Trump was inaugurated have been hard. And it's not always easy to see or remember that it was only 6 months ago that 3.5 million people took to the streets the day after Trump's election to stand against him. It has not been an upward line of struggle since then. And if you think about it, how could it have been? We just started to get our feet back under us after decades of assault and retreat. We'd just had the Sanders campaign, where 11 million people voted for an open socialist, and our side was put back on the agenda. We had just begun to have the protests of the Black Lives Matter movement that began to reassert the struggle against racism in this country. We had just gone through the struggle at Standing Rock, one of the largest in a 500-year history against indigenous expropriation and oppression that inspired everyone around this country, where people got in their cars, they got on planes, and they found their way to Standing Rock because they said, this is where I need to be, because I need to be in solidarity. The struggle is where I belong. We had just begun to rebuild our side, and then came the election. And their side went on the offensive, which I thought was summed up in this meme saying that I saw. Said, first they came for the Latinos, Muslims, women, gays, poor people, intellectuals, and scientists. And then it was Wednesday. I think that really sums up the experience of the initial weeks and months of the Trump administration, where there's that feeling of what Naomi Klein called shock, the shock doctrine, that they're just coming at you one after another after another. So that was one of the factors that I think led to a not upward ascendant line of struggle. But there are other parts of it. There's the question of who is the resistance. There's the resistance that's on the streets, the 3.5 million people across the country. There's the resistance that, when the Muslim travel ban went into effect, found their way to the airports and bore witness and defeated the first wave of that. But then there's the resistance of the Democratic Party, summed up in their new campaign slogan. This is the resistance. I mean, have you seen the other guys? I read an article today that was deeply distressing to me, and I was trying to figure out, it seemed very symbolic of our moment. The mayor of New York City, where I'm from, the largest city in New York City, Bill de Blasio, apparently is at protesting the G20 summit.
Literally.
Yes, but called into his weekly radio show to answer a question from a listener and said that he hated panhandling so much that he wished he could make it illegal. If this is the resistance, we've got problems. But luckily, that is not the resistance. Because beneath all of this, beneath sometimes the seeming quietude, beneath the vicious racism that we see every day, beneath these attacks that Wael talked about, there is a deep reservoir of discontent. That awakening, that sense that we deserve more, the search for alternatives to this system, it is still there, and I believe it is deepening. And I was powerfully reminded of it this afternoon when I was at a meeting on the fight against fascism, actually the early fight against fascism in the 1920s and 1930s. And someone named Cy got up, I don't know if Cy is here, and announced that they had just joined the ISO an hour earlier. And and what they said really struck me. They said, I hadn't been an activist before Trump's election because I thought that was something other people did. But I woke up after Trump. I joined the Democratic County Committee, but it was just like the Republican County Committee. And so I just started going left and ended up here. Actually, I didn't go left. The ground underneath me went right. I will not go back. Mass movement or not, I refuse to let them come for us and bring back what I fought against when I was a young person. This is someone's older. But I really hope there's a mass movement because I don't want to do it alone, and I know we can't win alone. That Cy is not alone. That there are hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, like her. And that is the starting point, not only for the building of a real resistance, but for building a left that can pose a real alternative. Because let's be clear, we need a real alternative. We need fights over any number of pressing issues. We need to build emergency response networks against raids, deportations, and racist attacks. We need to fight to keep abortion clinics open. We need to not only stop Trump care, but fight for Medicare for all. Everybody in. Nobody out. We need to fight police murders. We need to fight the Muslim travel ban. We need to fight anywhere and everywhere that our side faces attacks. But Naomi Klein is right. No is not enough. At a session earlier today on how the socialist movement responded to the fascist movement in the 20s and 30s, there was a quote from Clara Zetkin, who was a socialist at that time. And she talked about the stakes of what it means to build an alternative to fascism in a world that's falling apart. She said, "People are longing for new and unshakable ideals and a world outlook that enables them to understand nature, society, and their own life. Such an alternative is not measured in election cycles, and neither is the social devastation, the economic immiseration, the attempt to strip ordinary people of their basic dignity. This long predates Trump. It even predates the latest round of crisis that began in 2008. These are built into the system of capitalism itself, and any alternative has to address itself to that fact. That system cannot just be reformed. It must be uprooted from its very foundations and replaced with a different system, one based on the majority, on the idea that we are many, they are few, and we should run the world in our interests, not theirs." Baldwin, who there was a talk on today that I heard was amazing, once wrote, "The civilized have created the wretched quite coldly and deliberately and do not intend to change the status quo, are responsible for their slaughter and enslavement, rain down bombs on defenseless children whenever and wherever they decide that their vital interests are menaced, and think nothing of torturing a man to death. These people are not to be taken seriously when they speak of the sanctity of human life or the conscience of the civilized world." What does that look like? It looks like horror that makes you want to close your eyes and stop your ears, because sometimes it's too much to bear. But as on the sign on the daycare of Kiangi Yamada Taylor's sunset on the day of Inauguration Day, we need to keep our eyes wide open. I forced myself to watch the video of Diamond Reynolds, Philando Castile's fiance, and her four-year-old daughter in handcuffs in the back of a police car after having just watched police officer Geronimo Yanez shoot and kill Castile. I forced myself because, as Baldwin is quoted in the title for that meeting, nothing can be changed until it is faced. And America must face that four-year-old girl who pleads with her mother to be quiet because, "I don't want you to be shooted." And then the words that break your heart into a million pieces, "I'll take care of you, mommy." I repeat, America must face that four-year-old girl. America must face the fact that this is a country in which racism is not the spasm of a single man, or even the right-wing bands that we see mobilizing today. It is built into the very lifeblood of this system, and it must be torn down and razed to the ground along with this system. Epidemic. A study just came out that it looks like more Americans were killed this year by opioids than Americans were killed in the wars in Vietnam and Iraq combined, just in the last year. Think about what that means. Ahmed mentioned Grenfell. I was transfixed, and I'm sure most of you were, watching what happened at Grenfell, where they won't even tell you how many people died because they are afraid that it will provoke riots. They won't even talk about the scale of the suffering that took place there. That was purely, as Ahmed said, for profit, purely to save a couple of bucks. They deliberately, knowingly allowed dozens, if not more than 100 or hundreds of people to die in that fire. The only thing that's worse than watching that is knowing that there's a Grenfell every day in this world that is invisible. There is a Grenfell every day on the Mediterranean where refugees are deliberately murdered by policies that close their borders and don't allow people to come in. I live in New York City, and it's routine for us to talk about how on the MTA, the subway, that's gonna be our Grenfell. There's already been so many derailments and accidents that people know. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And this happens every day, and it's usually invisible. But I want to talk about the times when it's lifted. And watching Grenfell, I was reminded of something that's a long time ago, 12 years ago at this point, which was Hurricane Katrina in this country. Because it's another time when that veil was lifted, and the scale of crisis and devastation that seems unbelievable in the richest country in the world was revealed. 25,000 people were crowded into an Astrodome for 4 days with no food, no water, overflowing toilets, people dying right on the floor while babies screamed and cried. It's hard to imagine the horrors that children had to witness. Stories of mothers cutting themselves so they could feed their children blood to keep them from dehydrating. Hospitals with no electricity where dead bodies were piled in the stairwells. And nurses kept them alive with sugar solution IVs. But the most horrifying thing of all was that this tragedy could have been prevented. From before the storm hit to the administration's response to the crisis, Katrina exposed the completely unnatural social and economic relations that lie at the heart of this system. There were levees. They knew what a disaster this would be, and they cut the funds anyway. They incorporated FEMA into Homeland Security, not about saving people, but imposing a police state. Once the storm hit, residents were told to evacuate, but no plans made for those who could not afford to go or had nowhere to go. Majority of New Orleans, black and poor, people living paycheck to paycheck, who could not get the $20 together for gas money, let alone a hotel room. People went 4 days without food, water, or rescue before a real relief effort could be mounted. Not because it wasn't possible. There was a military ship with thousands of hospital beds right outside of New Orleans in the Gulf. Buses just outside the city. Airlines, helicopters, and private buses that could have been marshaled. But it wasn't just a story of incompetence. What came out was that... Sorry, they're giving me water. Where stories came out about how people could have walked across a bridge into safety, but they were stopped by lines of police who would not allow the poor, black, and dispossessed to escape. Police were told to stop rescue missions to stop looters who were trying to take whatever they could to survive. The buses stopped evacuating the Superdome to evacuate 800 guests of the Hyatt next door. Oh, the Hyatt. And then once the National Guard did arrive, they turned New Orleans into a police state with orders to shoot to kill. The Army Times described it as a combat operation. Now that was 12 years ago. Today, New Orleans is a model of neoliberal austerity, run by charter schools, completely devastated. The world watched and responded, but without actually imposing our solution to that crisis, their side was able to continue to devastate. Now, I think social workers should rerun the story that two of our comrades wrote during that time. Because Larry Bradshaw and Lori Beth Slonsky were actually there. They were EMTs who were there for a conference. And they documented what they saw there, and they documented how they organized people. They broke the story about police stopping them with guns as they tried to march on the bridge out of New Orleans. They documented that, but they said something else too. They said, what you will not see, but we witnessed, were the real heroes and sheroes of the hurricane relief effort. The working class of New Orleans, the maintenance workers who used a forklift to carry the sick and disabled, the engineers who rigged, nurtured, and kept the generators running, the electricians who improvised thick extension cords stretching over blocks to share the little electricity we had, nurses who took over for mechanical ventilators and spent many hours on end manually forcing air into the lungs of unconscious patients to keep them alive. And they go on and on and on. When we talk about needing to put forward an alternative, that's the alternative that we are talking about. It is the ordinary people who in every crisis sacrifice themselves and put themselves at the front while the tiny parasitical minority watches on as we die. That's the alternative. And Larry Bradshaw told a story when he was giving talks about this that made such an impression on me. Because he talked about the socialist training that had got him through New Orleans. They did get out safely. And he said four things that he learned as a socialist that he took with him in New Orleans. Self-activity. We have to do it for ourselves. Working class people have to do it for ourselves. That's one. Two, don't trust the cops. Authority lie to you.
Yeah.
Four, fight the divisions to achieve unity. These seem like some pretty simple guidelines, but they are at the heart of the socialist project. To know that this happened in 2005 and that we are still fighting today tells us something, though. A person at a meeting I gave last night asked, "Can we defeat capitalism?" My answer? Yes. I believe that we can defeat capitalism. I believe it because we have seen it. I believe it because we have time and time again seen ordinary people rise up against inhuman conditions and begin to put forward a different alternative. And not even all that long ago. Amit talked about Egypt. It's only been 6 years since the Egyptian revolution, and it can feel like forever ago. But it was a moment where it felt like the whole world was opening up. Millions of people streaming into the squares, organizing themselves, men and women together, cordons of people fighting the police, cordons of Muslims in a majority Muslim country organizing to protect Christians as they said their prayers. It was a moment where all eyes were on Egypt, and people began to rise around the world in Madison, Wisconsin, in Occupy Wall Street in New York City, in Greece, around and around and around. And you can see the potential that exists in those moments. And Omar Barghouti wrote a beautiful letter from Egypt at that time that I think speaks to what it feels like to be in a revolutionary moment like that. He said, "I wish you Egypt so you can tear apart the sheet with the multiple choice question, what do you want? For all the answers you are given are dead wrong. Your only chance there seems to be between evil and a lesser one. I wish you Egypt so you can, like the Tunisians, the Egyptians, the Libyans, the Bahrainis, the Yemenis, and certainly the Palestinians, shout. No, we do not want to select the least wrong answer. We want another choice altogether that is not on your damn list. Between slavery and death, we unequivocally opt for freedom and dignified life. No slavery and no death. Our oppression and yours are deeply interrelated and intertwined. It is never a zero-sum game. Our joint struggle for universal rights and freedoms is not merely a self-gratifying slogan that we raise. Rather, it is a fight for true emancipation and self-determination, an idea whose time has vociferously arrived. After Egypt, it is our time. It is time for Palestinian freedom and justice. It is time for all the people of this world, particularly the most exploited and downtrodden, to reassert our common humanity and reclaim control over our common destiny. I wish you Egypt. Now, that is both incredibly beautiful and incredibly tragic, because we know what happened after Egypt, and people should listen to Anand Gopal's talk today on revolution and counter-revolution in the Middle East. Because the revolutions in Egypt were followed by a wave of counter-revolution that we were not prepared to stand against. Millions of people moved into motion, but our side, the forces of the revolutionary left, the organized forces that could take those struggles forward, were not yet strong enough. They had not yet been born. And it was too quick. We weren't able to build it that quickly in that moment. And so our side lost that round with incredibly devastating consequences. But the answer to that is not to despair. And the answer to that is not to give up. Because for whatever the consequences of the counter-revolution and what the people of the Middle East and the people around the world, the price people were forced to pay for that pales in comparison to the price that our side will be forced to pay if we are not able to assert an alternative to this system and what they have in mind for us. Like this is not measured in election cycles. It's not even measured in years or even decades. The reality is we don't know the measurement of time and what it will take to build that alternative. What we do know is that building that alternative is a necessity. It is the only way forward. It is the only thing that has ever changed the world. And so we need to commit ourselves to building that fight in the knowledge that people only endure oppression and misery for so long before they rise up. And so the question is not, will people rise up? The question is, will the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who we have seen awakened in the last 6 months, the people who believe that it is time now for them to be activists, for them to join the resistance, out of that, will there be a layer of 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 people who dedicate themselves not just to joining the next protest, not just to joining the resistance, but to joining the fight, joining a revolutionary fight for a different world? That is the question that is before us. And I'm not going to pretend there's anything easy about that struggle. But it is the only way, I think, to live as a human being in the kind of world that we live in. And I'm going to end with a quote from Leon Trotsky, who was a leader of the Russian Revolution, and who we owe a great debt to, because as Stalinism wiped out the legacy of what real workers' revolution, real socialism democracy looked like, Trotsky kept that alive in tiny, tiny handfuls and numbers for people like us to take up and transmit to a new generation of people who are willing to fight. And he ended his life with no regrets, and he said this: For 43 years of my conscious life, I've remained a revolutionist. For 42 of them, I fought under the banner of Marxism. If I had to begin all over again, I would of course try and avoid this or that mistake, but the main course of my life would remain unchanged. I shall die a proletarian revolutionist, a Marxist, a dialectical materialist, and consequently, an irreconcilable atheist. My faith in the communist future of mankind is not less ardent, indeed it is firmer today than it was in the days of my youth. Natasha has just come up to the window from the courtyard and opened it wider so that the air may enter more freely into my room. I can see the bright green strip of grass beneath the wall and the clear blue sky above the wall and sunlight everywhere. Life is beautiful. Let the future generations cleanse it of all evil, oppression, and violence, and enjoy it to the full. Let us be that generation.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.